From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up,
I am very proud to announce today that we have reached a deal to end the shutdown and reopen the federal government.
President Trump says the longest government shutdown in history is over, at least until February 15th. We'll explain. Also today, we talk with the new leader of a physician group advocating for single-payer health care.
But really, it is going to be a big fight, and there's still a long way to go.
And a Simmons professor argues that the narrative may be wrong about spouses of some of the men accused in the Me Too movement. Plus, we remember the late poet Mary Oliver.
I got saved by poetry, and I got saved by the beauty of the world.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, the government shutdown is over, at least for now. About a half hour ago, President Trump announced a deal to reopen the government until February 15th, which puts an end to the longest government shutdown in history.
I will make sure that all employees receive their back pay very quickly or as soon as possible. It'll happen fast. I am asking Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to put this proposal on the floor immediately.
After saying for weeks that he would not reopen the government without money for a border wall, the president today said he would soon sign a bill to reopen the government temporarily while he negotiates with Congress. He said a bipartisan committee of lawmakers will be formed to consider broader spending before that February 15th deadline. Well, joining us to talk more about this is Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern. He's in Worcester today. Hello, Congressman. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be with you.
So what's your reaction to this announcement from the president today?
Well, I'm relieved, and I'm relieved especially for the 800,000 federal workers who weren't getting paid and still showing up to work. But this is the same deal that was on the table in December. So it's frustrating that the president decided to hold all these workers and indeed the country hostage, over a temper tantrum. But the bill that Mitch McConnell will bring to the Senate floor is what we sent them over, a while ago. So the government will reopen and we can have a discussion on border security and ways to enhance our border security. I mean, we can, cameras and sensors and drones and increased infrastructure and more personnel and more asylum judges, all those things I think are appropriate. But I think the president realized that the American people didn't think it was worth shutting down the government over a stupid wall. In fact, 70% of the American people thought it was a bad idea.
But, he said those same things, though, today. I mean, a wall, not a concrete wall, he said, a steel wall. And there will be drones and there will be technology and there will be more judges. But that's still his plan. I mean, what's the difference here, except it's going until February 15th?
Well, I mean, the difference is that he caved. And I think that's important. And I think I'm glad he did, because I think what he put the country through was unconscionable. But the deal is that I think it'll be more difficult for him to want to shut the government down again. And look, there are areas where we can come together, Democrats and Republicans and even people in this administration, on ways to enhance border security. But why would anybody want to spend, it's not just $5 billion, it's tens of billions of dollars on a wall that by almost all accounts of all the experts I've talked to say would be useless, is a waste of money. We ought to spend that money in a way that's more constructive, that indeed does deal with some real issues on our border.
You know, Congressman, you say, he caved. But I want to play a little piece of tape here from the president's press conference today that suggests maybe he caved now, but he's not going to cave in 3 weeks. Let's listen.
If we don't get a fair deal from Congress, the government will either shut down on February 15th again, or I will use the powers afforded to me under the laws and the Constitution of the United States to address this emergency.
Congressman McGovern, what do you say to that? Is that an empty threat?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I thought what was interesting was that he added that he will try to use his executive powers to be able to get what he wants. And if he tries to do that, you know, we'll see him in court. But the bottom line is that, you know, Democrats and Republicans agree on, you know, on a wide range of issues when it comes to border security. But there is dissension on this wall, which is a waste of money. It is ineffective. And it's not just Democrats who feel that way. There's some Republicans who feel that way as well. This was a campaign slogan that the president used during his campaign. And during his campaign, he said Mexico was going to pay for it. Well, now he's asking the taxpayers to pay for it. And we've seen from the poll numbers that the overwhelming majority of Americans, Democrats, independents, Republicans, do not want this. And so the government's open. That's good. And people can get paid. That's a good thing. This should never happen to begin with. This was an embarrassment. And it should never, ever happen again.
Yeah. But we're hearing the same debate again. So you said what there are areas where both sides could come together on this. Right. Give me two of them.
I mean, increase personnel on the border, upgrading our infrastructure. Some of the facilities that we have on the border are falling apart. Drones, cameras, sensors. More asylum judges to be able to, you know, adjudicate the backlog of asylum cases. I mean, those are things that I think we all can come together on. That's a wise investment of taxpayer money. What the president is suggesting, again, is a press release, is a slogan. That is a waste of money. I appreciate, you know, the fact that he, you know, sounded very much like he did. It sounded very much today like he did yesterday. But the important thing is that he opened up. That he's allowing for the government to open up. And what we have been saying from day one is that the American people shouldn't be pawns in this debate. Open the government up, pay the workers who are serving the American people, have some respect for them. And today, I think he saw the writing on the wall, and he's losing this in the public opinion polls. He finally acquiesced and basically asked Mitch McConnell to pass a bill that, you know, we could have passed in December.
Just briefly, Congressman, in terms of cost, you might be able to come together. You might be able to say that there are things that you do think make sense to improve border security. But there's a big discrepancy here in terms of what that might cost. President says $5 billion. What do you think the other side might say?
Well, he's saying $5 billion for the wall. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying is that we're happy to invest that kind of money in things that will work and not a wall. And we will have this discussion over the next few weeks without the government being shut down. And I think the Democrats and Republicans can come together. The question is whether the president, you know, will abide by what the bipartisan consensus is, or whether he'll, you know, listen to some right-wing, you know, talk show and then change his mind at the last minute. I mean, look, this has been so frustrating for so many of my constituents and for people all across this country. This was unnecessary. I mean, the spending bills that we're talking about were bipartisan. Some of them passed the Senate unanimously. I mean, there was no controversy on any of these things. Mm-hmm. He just held all of these agencies and all these departments hostage and the American people hostage over a temper tantrum. And it has been harmful to this country, and it has hurt a lot of workers in this country, and it is frustrating as hell.
So are you optimistic?
I am optimistic that we can avoid another shutdown. And I think that is, you know, that is something we must insist on. And this is not the way government should work. There'll be disagreements. The president has to understand he's supposed to be the commander in chief, not the whiner in chief. And if you don't get your way on 100% of what you want, that doesn't mean you just shut the government down. It means you work and you negotiate as hard as you can, and you get the best deal that you can get. And Congress is an independent branch of the government. We are not a rubber stamp for the president. He has to deal with us. He has to take into consideration what our priorities are as well. So, you know, we ought to move forward with the intention of trying to, you know, find common ground. But we also ought to move forward with the intent that this can never happen again. This was unconscionable. This was reckless. This was stupid. And And again, I'm glad that it seems to be over with for today. But it has been frustrating for a lot of people in this country.
All right, Congressman Jim McGovern, thanks so much for being with us.
All the best.
I want to continue to talk about this with our Week in Review panelist today, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Ideas and Opinion page. Cognoscenti is with us in studio. Hi there, Tom.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Reverend, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, you guys picked a pretty exciting day.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing going on much, huh? I'm wondering
if we're free to fly again.
Well, let's first hear a little bit more because this press camp. Press conference from the president happened less than an hour ago. We've got a piece of tape here from the president announcing once again, in case you missed it, a 3-week deal to reopen the government. The president said it would be open until February 15th. He put an end to the longest government shutdown in history. Let's listen.
Walls should not be controversial. Our country has built 654 miles of barrier over the last 15 years, and every career Border Patrol agent I have spoken with has told me that walls work. They do work. No matter where you go, they work.
That's President Trump at a press conference earlier this afternoon announcing the end of the government shutdown, saying negotiations will continue, but they will include a wall. Tom, it doesn't sound like he's saying anything different than what he said before. What gives here?
He is not saying anything different, but we've had the passage of time and we've had a shutdown. And it's one where the Democrats held strong. The Republicans were the ones who started to cave. And most importantly, Trump's numbers started to go down in terms of his favorabilities. I think that's what might make this different. That's why I think Congressman McGovern is probably right that there will be a huge reluctance on the part of the president to expose himself yet to further damage, and huge reluctance on the part of the Republicans in the Senate in particular to expose themselves to further damage. I also think what he has in his back pocket is he'll declare a national emergency and he'll fund it this way. And so what will happen is you'll have this two-step process. You'll have a permanent spending bill passes because he's going to be basically using his executive power. And then simultaneously, you're going to have challenges from the Democrats against him using this and declaring this as a national emergency. And we'll fight it out in the courts rather than the Congress.
Hmm. You know, I want to talk about why we think this happened today. You know, there's been a lot going on. We heard, obviously, earlier this morning from the Federal Aviation Administration, right, that there were delays in air travel because of what they said was a slight increase in sick leave. And there are concerns about public safety and about our airport safety. And, you know, we here at WBUR have been speaking with local folks affected by the shutdown. I want to play a little bit of tape here from a woman, Amy Chittum. Her husband's in the Coast Guard. And when we spoke with her, her husband had not had a paycheck. Earlier this week, we spoke with her, by the way. Her husband had not had a paycheck in about a month. Let's listen.
I think that holding people financially hostage is wrong, and it needs to end. If we really want border security, enlarge the Coast Guard, enlarge border security for the other agents that work. They are the wall. They're the ones who are stopping the people from coming across the waterways and into the ports.
Mariama White-Hammond, I'm just wondering, were these concerns from the 800,000 workers, do you think, a big issue here in getting to where we got to today in this announcement of the end of the government shutdown? Were there security concerns, all of the above? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think in the very beginning, we have some strong systems in a number of places, but I mean, I think everybody knows that there comes a point at which if you don't, you know, make sure that those systems are well funded and they have what they need, that they're going to start falling apart. So I think, you know, I was at the airport on Monday. I think people going through were kind of well aware, like, how can I be asking this person to check my bag and I know that they're not getting paid? So I do think, yes, it was, you know, the speaking out is, you know, it's unconscionable that Coast Guard, active Coast Guard agents are going to food banks, you know, to feed their family. And so I think that, you know, you have this sort of these images sort of beginning to mount and the concern that what if you have not enough TSA agents to open one day? What if you start having not enough air traffic controllers to actually make sure that planes are landing? Mm. There comes a point where if you push it to the edge that a catastrophe happens, you're going to get a kind of blowback that will not be short-lived. And so I think that there was, to some extent, a recognition is that if you push this too long, something's going to happen, and people are going to blame that on the shutdown. And ultimately, if lives are lost, you're going to have a real tough time.
Right, but is this a big loss for Republicans here? I mean, is this like a big defeat for them saying, okay, we lost? Thoughts here?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's really complicated. I mean, I think that the reality is that they're behind a leader who marches to his own drum, maybe that none of us can hear the beat of, right? And so you have a challenge where, you know, whether people like it or not, he's become the leader of that party. And I think that there are, you know, I have friends who are Republican that are struggling with, you know, what do you do when one person to some extent is holding hostage the entire party and he's, you know, he's the face, right? Mm. Like, how do you negotiate that? So I think that the soul searching that Republicans have to do around this is not new soul searching, but it certainly has been pushed to an extreme.
Yeah, I less than characterizing this as a loss for the Republicans, I would characterize it as a win for the Democrats, and in particular for one Democrat, Nancy Pelosi, who really showed her mettle, really showed her skill. She outdueled Donald Trump, the master of the deal, and she beat him thoroughly. And I think that she has shown the power of someone being in control of the House and of what happens with divided government. And she's really shown that she can go toe-to-toe with them.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens from here. You're confident, though, that we won't see another government shutdown, that we'll see some sort of a deal. This isn't going to be, oh, you're okay through Valentine's Day. Wow. And then it might happen.
I know.
I'm a woman of faith, but I have put aside predicting anything these days. Who knows what will happen?
Confidence, a tough term. I'll tell you how we could be confident about it. What we should actually do on a shutdown is actually shut down.
Right.
We shouldn't make workers come to work without pay. And I guarantee you that if we felt the pain of a shutdown rather than just putting it on the shoulders of 800,000 workers, but if we, the American public, felt the pain, if in fact on a shutdown airplanes couldn't fly, airports had to close, I don't think you'd have a shutdown of a day or more.
Hmm. Do you think we'll see a wall?
Do I think we'll see what?
A wall.
No.
No wall. Yeah.
No.
Who knows?
Oh, she's still not predicting.
Although I will say this. If there's a 40-foot wall, there will be 41-foot ladders that go
exactly.
on sale. So,
well, let's talk about some things close to home because we've had a lot happening this week. Governor Charlie Baker unveiled his almost $43 billion budget. Big focus on education in this budget. Let's listen to a bit of what he said when he made his announcement.
While our education reform package is a major component of our budget proposal, we're also making significant investments across the budget to build stronger communities, improve our transportation system, strengthen services for the most vulnerable, and protect the Commonwealth from a changing climate.
So let's dig into a few of those. First of those, education. The governor's proposal would increase the state's power to intervene in struggling schools. And this is controversial. What are your thoughts on this?
So it harkens to me back to the original education reform bill, which
right.
I think was 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the deal there
Not
was...
Not that I was old enough.
And basically the deal there was the state will really step up and put a lot of money into education, but it's going to demand some sort of metric, some sort of reforms in response. And I think, you know, Charlie Baker was around then. It was one of his mentors that basically was involved in doing that. And I think that that's what you're seeing again. The reality is that the money the state gives to localities at this point has fallen behind given inflation and so on. And also seems out of whack in terms of where the actual need is for these education dollars. But I would have to agree that just to throw money at the issue is kind of – that's what a Republican like Charlie Baker is not going to do. He's going to want to see that the money brings results and is going to demand some metrics in return.
Mm-hmm. Mariama, what do you think?
Yeah, so I want to say I celebrate that it focused on the core issues that I think need to be looked at. I think it's been long overdue to really look at the funding formula. And I don't have a problem with accountability. One of the questions I want to sort of ask is, have these takeovers been working? So I also want to get clear, when the state takes over, has it really moved the needle and does it, you know, sustain?
Mm.
Because as someone who's seen some of these things, there's a big hullabaloo at the beginning and the teachers get fired and da-da-da-da-da. And I'm not always sure that it's sustained.
Mm-hmm.
So I would appreciate, and I think anybody who's going to do this should really look, are the kids that need help the most really getting served by this? If the answer is yes, then that is great. If the answer is that the turnaround schools actually just move a different set of students in or are able to only sustain for a certain period of time, then I want to ask some questions about whether or not the intervention works. And I'm not saying I know the answer to that fully, but I think there has been a tendency to assume that giving the state more power will lead to better outcomes. And I'm just not sure that I see evidence that that is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't disagree with you in terms of the specifics of a particular strategy. Mm-hmm. But I would say that since 1993 and when we had the reform bill, Massachusetts educational system as measured by international testing mm-hmm. has dramatically improved. We are first or second in the nation on almost any measure in terms of student achievement. And that's been a huge success. If we can continue to... Now, maybe that's just because we blindly spend money, but I think it's because we have been spending that money in smarter ways and demanding some outcomes from the spending of that money. We've had success so far. What I'm hoping is that this increased spending builds on that success.
And I guess I agree that there has been success overall. The question is, a lot of this conversation is about closing the achievement gap.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And we did see a bump, but we have started to see some stagnation.
Right.
And my question is... I want to make sure that those children are well served, and I'm not positive that the state has a better strategy than municipalities. I'm not saying I'm clear one way or the other. I just want to explore if we're doing the best to really get to those kids who are struggling the most, mm-hmm. which is what we say we want to do. We've seen the tide raise many, many boats, but there are still a group of young people that are really, really struggling.
Right.
The Globe's piece around the valedictorians.
Right.
You're talking about the kids who pushed their way and did very, very well and still finding themselves locked out of prosperity. So the question for me is, if the long-term goal is to educate our children so that they have access to the best opportunities, and we can't do that for our valedictorians in some instances, do we need to have a deeper conversation about what needs to happen? And I hope that this next infusion of resources will try to help us get to that deeper question, which... To be honest with you, in my opinion, it definitely needs to impact schools, but it extends beyond schools too, and beyond K to 12 education. We need to have some deeper conversation about generational poverty, et cetera. And maybe there are other partners that need to be part of this conversation. I'm just saying, I'm glad our tests are improving. I'm glad our kids are doing better. And I'm seeing some things continue to be stuck. That means we should have a deeper conversation about our strategy.
So this idea about the state perhaps having more control is something you're a little skeptical about.
Yeah, if it doesn't produce higher outcomes, then I don't necessarily think it – I don't think it makes sense. If it does, great. If we're stuck in some places, let's look at those places and let's really figure out what is going to support those kids.
Right. And the only thing I would add to that is that the problem of the achievement gap is not – wholly the fault of the schools. The problem of the achievement gap has to do with a whole series of circumstances that affect the child at a very, very young age. Mm-hmm. That means that by the time that child goes to school, that child is already behind. So it's not the schools that caused it. And part of what I'd really love to see in something like this is an emphasis not only on the school, but also on the whole series of wraparound services. Mm-hmm. Social services, health services, food services to make sure the kids actually being fed well.
Right.
Or deepening our investment in early childhood. Like my question is ultimately, for the kids who have struggled, what do we need to do and how do we make sure that the money goes to making sure? Because just getting them to pass the MCAS is not...
Right.
In and of itself, producing the fullness of outcomes we desire. Right. And so I hope we will have a more robust conversation. Mm.
But if we go back to the governor's budget, so education was one pot of money that he talked about. He also, talked about climate change. And he's come up with this interesting proposal of a 0.2% increase in the deeds tax to use some of that money for climate change. He says it would raise about $1 billion over the next 10 years. He's also talked about taxing receipts on opioids. Manufacturers to use some of that money to pay for the opioid epidemic. This is a Republican governor saying the T word. What's going on here, Tom? I mean, is this emboldened?
Are you sure he's a Republican? I really watched. I watched and followed the most recent reelection quite carefully, and I don't remember him mentioning that he was a Republican.
See, I think he's changed.
He was the most popular governor in the country. Remember that?
Yeah. Well, I want to applaud the opportunity to say I'm glad he's putting revenue on the table. And I hope that a lot of other people will join in that, because I think one of the challenges is that when you say taxes, there's a whole chorus of people who will, you know, begin crying. For those of us who want to make sure that, you know, my house is in a floodplain, I want us to start talking about climate change, because it isn't going to last all the years that I'm putting into it if we don't do something now. Mm-hmm. So I think I will say, as a citizen, if we need more money to do what we need to do, let's do it.
It's interesting. I think we're going to see more resistance from the House than we're actually going to see from the governor's office in terms of new taxes.
And just briefly, speaking of taxes, Senator Warren, her presidential bid, she has a tax plan, an ultra-millionaire's tax plan, where she wants to tax folks who are making more than, who have net worth of more than $50 million. So far, what are your thoughts, just very briefly, because we're running out of time, on her campaign and then the entrance this week of Kamala Harris, California senator, is also seeking the nomination. Tom?
I think Warren's plan's actually kind of interesting. There's been a lot of proposals out there on 70-90% tax rates on income, and she actually has really rejected that and argued that what you should do is focus on wealth. Now, implementing that strikes me as crazy, because that means all of a sudden every one of us is going to have to file a new return testifying to our actual net worth and things like that, which is going to be kind of complicated. Many people don't even know what their net worth is. I'm also not sure that that's going to get after people like Jeff Bezos, whose net worth, if you think about it, is not in dollars, but really in the potential value of the stock that he owns. And I'm not sure how you take that away. Having said that, her entrance, Kamala Harris's entrance, the entrance of a number of other people into this tells you that this is going to be a very robust Democratic primary. We're going to see a lot of new faces coming in, as well as I expect some old faces like Joe Biden. Wouldn't surprise me if we had 10 to 15 people, serious people in this race.
Mariella?
Well, I'm excited. You know, I can't do an analysis. Like, I'm not an economist. But what I can say is I think that I like that both Warren's proposal, AOC's proposal, is making people have a conversation. I saw a pretty interesting quote where an executive, I won't call him out specifically, said, a 70% tax rate, that's un-American. Where did you get that from? And someone said, America. That's what it used to be, right? And so I think we haven't had a conversation about what makes sense and what is fair. And we may not end up exactly with Warren's proposal, but at least we're having a robust conversation about something we need to talk about.
All right. Well, sorry for the shortened conversation today with the breaking news that the government shutdown is over, at least for now. The president announced, President Trump announced that about an hour ago. He says the government shutdown will be over until February 15th. That'll give everyone time to try to negotiate a deal on border security. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Ideas and Opinion page, Cognoscenti. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Also, Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Thank you.
Good to be here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The debate over health care, particularly single-payer health care, is front and center on the political stage.
Everyone gets a right to basic health care. That's what Medicare for All is all about, and that's why we're here.
The reason that I am supporting Medicare for All is it's pretty basic. I believe that it's simply the moral and ethical thing to do.
We are no longer going to get ripped off and pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs on the Medicare for All. We're going to negotiate.
And this attention is welcome news to the group Physicians for a National Health Program. They're health professionals who advocate for a single-payer health system. Dr. Adam Gaffney, a pulmonary specialist at the Cambridge Health Alliance and Harvard Medical School, is the newly elected president of the group, and he joins us in studio. Welcome, Dr. Gaffney.
Thank you for having me.
So this attention on single-payer health care, is that good news for you?
It's an exciting development. We've come so far in recent years. Public understanding of the importance of single payer has risen. There has been obviously a major increase in support for a single payer bill in both the House and the Senate. And so we're very heartened. But obviously, there's major obstacles ahead, particularly from powerful healthcare corporations.
And when you say single payer, are you talking a Medicare-like system that would be run for everybody?
Medicare, but better. We call it improved Medicare for all. Mm-hmm. Basically, comprehensive benefits, universal coverage for everyone in the country, no copays or deductibles. And it sounds really good, and it's also very doable, as the experience of many other nations tells us.
Well, the arguments against it, I'll play devil's advocate here. Somebody's got to. So the arguments have been cost and quality. So let's start with the big one, cost. Wildly different estimates have come out about, you know, trillions. It's going to cost trillions. We're never going to be able to afford this. Your taxes. Oh, my goodness. So give me your estimate. What's it going to cost to do this enhanced Medicare for All program?
Well, a lot of the debate about this is very misleading. What matters is what we spend overall as a country on health care. Some of the money that is currently being spent on premiums, copays, deductibles will be replaced by taxes. But overall, even the estimate from the Mercatus Center, which is a libertarian think tank, actually found that overall health care spending would fall with implementation of Medicare for All. So there's a lot of misleading rhetoric about the costs. Yes, we'll have to replace some of the private premiums with some new taxes, but as a nation as a whole, we can expect to spend no more, probably somewhat less than we're currently spending.
And when you say that you're talking about spending as a nation on health care, you want to say that because I think that Mercatus, I mean, I thought they said something like $32 trillion over 10 years. Is that right?
They are. So there's two different things. One is total health care spending as a nation. They estimated that overall health care spending as a nation would in fact fall. But yes, there would need to be some new taxes to replace existing premiums, okay? So they're two different things. But what really matters to the average American is not whether they're paying, a certain amount of money to a premium or to a tax. What matters is overall how much are you spending on healthcare.
Right.
And that is not going to go up because for every $1 increase in taxes, we're talking about more savings through lower through getting rid of premiums and getting rid of copays and deductibles. So overall, people would do better. And more importantly, they would never need to worry about not being able to get the care they need because of costs.
Well, some folks say, though, if you look at other countries, as you mentioned, Canada, the UK, that's where the quality argument comes in. They say that folks do not have access all the time and certainly do not have timely access to health care. There are delays and waits and sometimes dangerous delays in getting necessary medical treatment. So what do you say to those folks about when they say, look at the systems in those countries, they're not really any better? Your response.
Well, they're certainly better. People are not going without needed care in Canada because they're uninsured. People are not, and I've seen people not get the care they need and wind up in the ICU because they are unable to attend to their medical problems. People are not going without needed medications because the copays are too high. People are living longer in those countries. Overall, the healthcare quality in those countries is in many respects is higher, as independent assessments have shown. So a lot of what we hear about these other nations is a lot of fear-mongering. One healthcare system is perfect. We want to combine the best of the American healthcare system as it is now with the best of how things work in other nations. We're not talking about totally copying any other country's healthcare system, and we can do better for sure.
And this would totally eliminate the health insurer. Is that right?
The health insurance industry plays no useful role. You have a single public program like Medicare, but give it to everyone and have it cover everything. You have enormous savings to be achieved by having a single public insurer. The private health insurance industry, the privatized, fragmented health insurance industry produces incredible waste in our system in terms of administrative costs, in terms of overhead, in terms of profit. So, yes, you have one public payer for everyone, and you produce enormous savings.
What about those who say, you know, we know that it's expensive now, and the costs really, you know, of course, we've heard, all of us have heard those horror stories about some really exorbitant costs of healthcare, but some say that those costs are so high because they actually subsidize research and other things so we can continue to be an innovative country in healthcare, and that's why we have research into all kinds of innovative treatments that help people live longer.
Well, first of all, an enormous amount of the research that's being done in this country is already publicly funded through the NIH. Okay, so let's not forget that. And yes, pharmaceutical companies are doing research. On the other hand, they have monopolies that allow them to basically charge whatever they want for those drugs. And so there's no question in my mind that we can bring down drug prices and still have as much innovation. Maybe that means spending a little more from the public purse on drug development, but we can do it and bring down drug prices.
I wonder, Dr. Gaffney, you know, we're talking about a group of healthcare professionals. When we say the Physicians for a National Health Program, would you say that the health professionals in this group are in the majority, that most of the physicians believe that this is the way to go?
Well, you know, it's surprising to some people to hear it, but the polling that has been done on this issue has found majority support among physicians for single payer. Mm. And, you know, why is that? Well, in many ways, the current system is not so great for doctors either, okay? Obviously, patients are being hurt in many ways, but it's not great for physicians in many ways. Physicians are spending more and more of their time on clerical activities, on paperwork, fighting with insurers, things that take them away from the bedside, away from the patient, and force them to instead waste it. So really, the current system isn't working great for physicians, and we think that this would make medicine better for both sides.
Hmm. Okay. So you're optimistic that there might be some movement on this, I think.
Oh, there's going to be movement. There's going to be developments in the weeks ahead. We're very excited, and we're going to make this happen. I don't know when, but we will.
All right, Dr. Adam Gaffney, pulmonary specialist at the Cambridge Health Alliance and Harvard Medical School. He's also the new president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The Me Too movement has put the public spotlight on not just some of the men accused of sexual misconduct, but on their spouses as well. Take the case of former CBS CEO Les Moonves and his wife, Julie Chen Moonves. She still works for CBS as host of the show Big Brother. She was known as Julie Chen, but recently she's been introducing herself with her husband's surname.
Good evening. I'm Julie Chen Moonves. Welcome to the Celebrity Big Brother two-night premiere event.
Joining us to talk about Me Too spouses is Suzanne Leonard, an associate professor at Simmons in Boston. She wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Review of Books this week called Fealty, Fortune, and the Wives of Me Too. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So for people not familiar with Julie Chen Moonves, tell me why using her full last name is a big deal.
Well, I think one of the first things to keep in mind is very few of the Me Too wives are public figures in their own right. They're not generally going out proclaiming themselves devoted to or not devoted to their embattled husbands. So I think the fact that Julie Chen Moonves was, to begin with, a public figure in her own right is worth mentioning. And the very deliberate decision to suddenly change her name in the midst of her husband's kind of being removed from CBS and now kind of fighting for a $120 million severance package that has now been revoked from him was really a statement of endorsement of a figure that is very a very different sort of move than you see, I think, most aggrieved wives make.
Hmm. So it's not she's standing by her man necessarily.
No, you know, I think what's really interesting about what we're seeing in these new paradigms is not so much standing by your man or not standing by your man, but a more, I think, sophisticated calculus about what marriage means and kind of what the face of these women's marriages mean in the public eye. And I think for Julie Chen to then adopt the surname Moonves really spoke to her kind of putting her own professional capital behind her husband, which is frankly not something, it's not a script that I think you see a lot of wives doing.
Mm. You write, when we talked about the LA Review of Books, you wrote, increasingly marriage is a mutual beneficial arrangement that's credited with consolidating wealth and power in America's mm-hmm. elite.
Yes. I mean, I think there's some really interesting sociological data that we need to think about here, which is to say that recent studies have shown that one of the best things women can do for their financial health is to get married and stay married. And increasing income disparity in our country is increasingly being aligned with being married or not being married. So there's a whole other much bigger conversation, I think, here about the way in which marriage consolidates power and wealth and leads to the growing income disparity in this country.
And some of the romantics might say, oh, no, no, you can't look at it like that, right?
Yeah, I'm often accused of being a little bit too pragmatic about this. But I think when we look at some of these public figures and the ways in which their professions are so entwined with their marriages, it's almost impossible not to be a little bit kind of colder in one's estimation of what's going on.
But is it also sort of putting them in a no-win situation? Either they're standing by this guy because mm-hmm. they believe in someone who may not exist, or they're just looking out for their own financial self-interest.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's so interesting about what Julie Chen Moonves has decided to do is that she has used very few words to say something very large, right? She didn't come out and make a public statement on behalf of her husband, nor did she quietly leave him. And so the fact that she was able to adopt, again, his surname, which she had never done before, I think was a really interesting public endorsement, which was to say, look, clearly it was a choice that she was going to stay in this marriage. Clearly, it was a choice that, you know, either she didn't believe the allegations against her husband or it was something they'd worked through and perhaps forgiven, and that she didn't necessarily need to do an interview to say that, but that simply identifying herself as she did really spoke to her endorsement of him, of their marriage, and of her part in being an equal partner through kind of his trials. Mm.
Of course, we can't really have this conversation without having sort of the pre-Me Too couple as part of mm-hmm. it, Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Absolutely.
And there was a lot going on there. What was your take on that and the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal? And mm-hmm. now, how has that evolved for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think something very interesting has happened with the case of Hillary and Bill. In part, the way in which his extramarital affair is now being recast post-Me Too, which is to say that Hillary Clinton got herself in quite a bit of trouble recently, actually, when she was asked about whether, sort of through this new lens that I think we rightfully have where consent may not be possible under conditions of, you know, extreme hierarchies in power, as one might say. I mean, Lewinsky was, by all accounts, a starstruck 22-year-old when she had her affair with Bill Clinton. And when Hillary was asked about this, you know, does this sort of qualify as a Me Too moment, she categorically denied it. She said that, you know, Lewinsky was an adult and, you know, that affair didn't take place in that register. And I think that was really interesting because it seemed to signal her in unwillingness to reckon with those power differentials that have really fueled the discussion surrounding the Me Too movement.
What do you think it says about us sort of having this fascination with how spouses deal with this type of thing? I mean, it's particularly women. Is it because of the changing roles of women, because we're curious about how other people deal with marriage? I mean, what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean,
All of the above.
I mean, I think we would be remiss to say, despite everything that's happened, that marriage doesn't still remain a mythologized event in many women's lives. And so suddenly when we see these marriages go so publicly bad, I think it gives us an opportunity to really reconcile with issues not just of power, but also of intimacy and of trust. And I think, in all honesty, these are sort of the bedrocks of human relationships. So I know it might seem sort of prurient to be fascinated with these couples, but I think in essence, what we're really trying to figure out is, you know, how do you broker a lifetime partnership? What are the rules on which that partnership is brokered? And, you know, what does it mean to violate those trusts? So I think there's actually some very sophisticated issues that are at play when we're talking about these public marriages.
So we shouldn't necessarily say that these women have been betrayed or shamed or anything like that. It's a new world.
I think it is.
For the spouses, too.
Yes, I would agree.
Yeah, that's what you're saying. Okay, just want to make sure. Suzanne Leonard, associate professor at Simmons University. Her latest book is Wife, Inc., The Business of Marriage in the 21st Century. You can read her piece in the Los Angeles Review of Books on our website at radioboston.org. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mm-hmm. Remembrances have been pouring in all week after the death of Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Mary Oliver. Among them are from people in Provincetown, where Oliver lived for more than 40 years. Joining us to talk about Mary Oliver is Nan Sinnater, lead librarian at the Provincetown Public Library. Nan, thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
So tell us how you met Mary Oliver.
Well, I was a longtime bookseller here in Provincetown, and when my bookstore closed, I started to work at the Provincetown Bookshop as a manager, and the Provincetown Bookshop had a longtime special relationship with Mary. So when the elderly owner, he was 93 at the time when I first started, said to me, "Call up Mary and ask her to sign some books," I said, "Call up Mary Oliver?" I had never even met Mary Oliver, but, you know, I knew her work. And he said, "Yeah, call up Mary." So I did, and I asked her if she would come and sign some books. And she said, "No, I'm too old." She said, "I'd be happy to sign them if you bring them to me."
And how old was she at this time?
Oh, that was, 7 or 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So she was in her 70s, I guess. Mm. And and so she said, "Bring them to me, and I'll sign them." So we started this routine where I brought two or three large boxes of books, because she signed everything, not just her new hardcover, but everything that we carried, which was everything by her. So I would bring her dozens of books, and I, you know, got to know her dog, Ricky, and I got to spend a little time just chatting with her every time I would drop off the books. And she would sign them and call me and tell me to come and get them, and I'd come back and get them. Usually I'd bring her flowers. Mm. And one time when she wasn't there, I came in and she had left a note with some golden chanterelle mushrooms for me. With an advisory that she thought that they were great for breakfast, sautéed in butter.
So she was a forager?
Yes, apparently so.
So
and I got the benefits.
You got the mushrooms, right? So you really got to know her then. You got to talk with her.
I got to talk with her. I can't say I got to know her. We were acquaintances, and friendly acquaintances at that. And we got to chat about her neighbors and her dog and what was going on in town and stuff like that. And we talked about the book business. She always wanted to know how her books were selling. And we talked about her change. I started working with her around the time that she changed over to Penguin from Beacon. Mm. And she talked about how it was, you know, worth it to her because she was going to make more money. And we talked book business and we talked town stuff.
Right. You know, I want to play a little bit of a clip here from an interview of Mary Oliver. She was speaking with Krista Tippett during the program titled On Being, and she explained some of her writing style. Let's listen.
I wanted the I. Many of the poems are I did this, I did this, I saw this. I wanted them, the I to be the possible reader, mm-hmm. rather than about myself. Mm-hmm. It was about an experience that happened to be mine but could well have been anybody else's.
I'm wondering, Nan, when you hear that, I mean, what do you think about, what strikes you about Mary Oliver's poems, and why do you think that they've influenced so many people? I think the New York Times said she was the best-selling poet in the country.
Yes, she was the best-selling poet in the country. When I looked her up a few years ago on Amazon, she was number two in poetry after Shakespeare. So that tells you something about
right.
how incredibly popular she was. I think that is the quote that I would have picked out from that interview as well. I was struck by that basically that the I is you, the I becomes you, the I becomes the reader instead of the writer as you were reading it.
Right.
And I think that she's, you know, she knew her poetry better than anybody else. I think she's absolutely right on the money about that each time you read her experience, you enter into it in a way that's kind of mystical. I don't know how she does it.
Hmm. So does the library have any special events going on to remember?
Yes, we're having, on Sunday, we're having an open mic reading of her poetry by anybody who cares to come and who wants to read their favorite poem.
Oh, great. And do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite?
Mm-hmm.
Well, along with about half the world, I would guess, Wild Geese.
Right, right. Is Wild Geese is your favorite. Yeah. Because, just briefly, what would you say?
Because it condenses and speaks directly to what she writes about all the time, which is your place in the wildness of the world.
All right. Well, Nan Senator, lead librarian at the Provincetown Public Library, we're going to go out with the last poem of Mary Oliver, reading some of Wild Geese. But thank you, Nan, for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Here's Mary Oliver again in that 2015 interview with Krista Tippett.
Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.
That was Mary Oliver reading her poem Wild Geese in 2015. Mary Oliver died last week. She was 83 years old. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.